Welcome to More Than Wealth with Darren Gold and Samantha Hotchkins from the Gold Wealth Management Group. In this podcast, we help business executives, business owners, and high net worth individuals navigate the multifaceted world of wealth planning. No matter how complex the situation, we provide financial advice and guidance to instill greater confidence in pursuing your life's goals. By leveraging the vast resources of UBS and collaborating with a team of external specialists, we'll delve into both basic and complex planning topics. Beyond the numbers, we'll also explore the stories behind the wealth. By interviewing business owners and thought leaders in our community, we aim to share insightful and inspiring tales of success. Join us on this journey where we explore wealth and the compelling stories behind it on More Than Wealth.
Hello and welcome to the More Than Wealth podcast with the team from Gold Wealth Management Group. Your hosts for the podcast are Darren Gold and Samantha Hotchkins. Today's podcast guest is Dr. Daniel Crosby, a psychologist and behavioral finance expert who helps individuals and organizations understand the intersection of mind and markets. He is the chief behavioral officer at Orient Advisors, a New York Times bestselling author, and a host of an award-winning podcast, Standard Deviations. Now, here are your hosts, Darren Gold and Samantha Hotchkins.
Hello and welcome to More Than Wealth. I'm Darren Gold.
And I'm Sam Hotchkins.
On today's podcast, we'll explore the intersections of money, psychology, and living a meaningful life with our very special guest, Dr. Daniel Crosby. Dr. Crosby is the chief behavioral scientist at Orion Advisor Solutions. He's also a New York Times bestselling author and host of his own podcast, Standard Deviations. Today, we'll be discussing his most recent book, The Soul of Wealth, a thought-provoking book that blends timeless wisdom with practical strategies to help us understand the deeper meaning of money and the behaviors that surround it. Dr. Crosby, welcome to the show.
Darren, good to be here.
Daniel, we're huge fans of your work, and especially the Soul of Wealth book really resonated with both of us. But before we jump into kind of the nitty-gritty of behavioral finance, I think it would be a big missed opportunity if we didn't just ask you kind of the inspiration behind the book.
Yeah, there were really two inspirations behind the book. One was a micro inspiration and one was a macro inspiration. On the personal level, I had a health scare that ended up being nothing. But during this health scare, I'm someone who loves money. I work in finance. I save lots of money. I love thinking about and writing about investing and saving and compounding wealth. And when I was sick, there was this moment when my wife was driving me to the hospital and I'm sitting in the front seat of her car crying and I don't know what's wrong with me, where I would have given you every dollar that I had to have answers about what was wrong with me and to feel better. And it was this real moment for me of, am I spending my time on the right stuff? And am I concerned about the right stuff? And what does true wealth mean? At the macro sort of societal level, there's a big conversation going around, which is why I think your podcast is so well positioned and your focus is so prescient. When this country was founded, 85% of the world was living on $2, what is today, $2 or less a day. I mean, everyone was poor, you know, even as recently as a couple of hundred years ago. And through largely the merits of capitalism, we now have a growing global middle class. Only 9% of the world now lives in poverty, up from, you know, down from 85% a couple hundred years ago. And yet we have a mental health crisis in this country. We have a crisis of loneliness and a crisis of obesity and all these things. The world has never been more abundant, and yet we've never been more sort of spiritually and existentially lost. So both at the micro and the macro level, this felt like an important work for me to get out in the world.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's such a powerful why. The story of your health scare and how that gave you the opportunity to zoom out a bit. And I totally agree. Something Sam and I talk about a lot is, you know, we, as you said, we're the wealthiest country in the world, but we're arriving in retirement more overstressed, more overweight, more overmedicated than at any other time in history. So it really is a powerful reminder. And I think your book is just so timely at this point. So great. So your book opens with a powerful reminder, and it's compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. Why do you think that we are so drawn to comparing ourselves to others when it comes to money?
So at the risk of getting a little deep here, we have to answer this question fully. We have to think about the greatest gift humankind possesses. And if you think about the rest of the animal kingdom, right, we aren't the strongest, we aren't the fastest, we don't have the sharpest claws or the sharpest teeth. So why are we ascendant? Why are we the top of the food chain? Well, the reason is because we can work together and we have empathy, and I can put myself in Sam's shoes or in Darren's shoes and we can cooperate. This is the greatest gift of humankind. This is what allows us to build religions and civilizations and write constitutions and build great economies, and why we are the most powerful animal. Well, that's mostly good. But it also means that we can also tend to get enmeshed with our fellow humans and over-identify with our fellow humans and benchmark to our fellow humans. And we really see that a lot with wealth, because once you get past sort of the bottom two rungs of Maslow's hierarchy, you know, once you have enough food to eat and a, you know, a warm place to sleep, wealth becomes kind of relative. And so determining whether or not you're rich or whether or not you're wealthy becomes a highly subjective enterprise. And what we find, there's research in the book that blew my mind when I came across it. When you look at people's felt wealth, you know, do you feel wealthy? If I ask someone, you know, hey, do you feel rich? Do you feel wealthy? There's two predictors, and they are equally predictive. The first is how much money do they have, which of course, right, we would expect to be the most powerful predictor of how wealthy someone feels. So there is some factual basis there. But 1A, the thing that is just as predictive as someone's actual wealth, is who they are benchmarking to, what shrinks like myself call their reference class. You know, who am I comparing myself to? And if you look back over the long course of human history, for most of human history, we knew like 100 people. I mean, there's good research to show that you can only kind of manage about 100 to 150 relationships, because historically we lived in a little village, we traded and swapped bread and eggs and, you know, farmed with about 100 other people. And we were benchmarking ourselves relative to those 100 people who by and large were from the same sort of tribe and same sort of socioeconomic realities. Well, now I can finish my call with Sam and Darren, open up my phone and, you know, compare my abs to, you know, a world-class athlete, and compare my bank account to Warren Buffett or Drake, right? You know, compare my car, you know, to some superstar. And so we live in a world now where we have this comparative reality, which humankind is prone to anyway, but we have it on steroids. And so being thoughtful about how you're benchmarking your success is as important as the success itself. And I think that most people just don't understand that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of the line, you know, comparison is the thief of happiness. And something else from your book you talked about was, you know, we buy things we don't need that we can't afford to impress people we don't like, which that was so spot on. So it was a really good takeaway for me.
Yeah, I mean, even social media now, I mean, you could follow anyone and easily compare yourself, which I think is great and also a hindrance. So thank you for that. Another concept I wanted to explore with you that you brought up in the book is this illusion of control, where people overestimate their ability to influence outcomes. How do you see this illusion popping up in investing and financial planning?
Yeah, so the illusion of control, again, when you look at most behavioral biases, there's a good reason why they exist. So, you know, the feeling that we are in control of our lives is one that we're all after, right? And you should do everything you can do to a reasonable extent to try and exert some level of control in your life, but we overextend it, or we think it's greater than it is. This pops up in a couple of places. One that's sort of fascinating is that people overinvest in the stock of the company for which they work, right? So like I'm from Atlanta. So there's a lot of people in this town here who are way over invested in like Coke stock because they work for Coca-Cola and they go, oh, well, because I work for Coke, I sort of know what's going on and I should invest in this company's stock. Well, unless you're the CEO of Coke, right? If you're, you know, the 2032nd accountant that works at Coke, you know, no offense, but your efforts aren't materially driving or impacting the share price of Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And now you're kind of doubling down on that risk, right? You placed all your chips on that one stack there, because now that's your employer, you know, and you're betting on that in sort of an undue way. So this sort of investing in things we know or places we work to an excessive degree is one thing. And then also over trading. You know, there's fascinating study done many years ago that talked about lottery tickets. And so, you know, Sam, think about if you know, think about your lucky number, right? So, you know, whether it's your birthday or, you know, your lucky number or whatever. And they would ask people, how much would you pay for a lottery ticket that is your lucky number versus a lottery ticket that Darren just picks out for you randomly? And people will pay like 10 times as much for a lottery ticket with their lucky number, even if the odds are the same. So you see all kinds of stuff like gambling, over trading, being excessively active with accounts, that all sort of boils down to this illusion of control and us thinking we have more sway over the universe than we actually do.
Yeah, and I think about, you know, just the financial planning, wealth management industry itself, and, you know, everything we do, all of the communication we have with clients, all of the work we do helping sort through dynamics with clients' families, I mean, all of that is behavioral science, behavioral finance. It's communication. Where do you think, I mean, based on what you know of our industry, you know, where do you think the industry is today, and what in the future going forward, what do you think, you know, tomorrow's successful wealth advisor will need to have in terms of a skill set to be successful?
Yeah. So if you look at the reasons why the average person hires a wealth advisor, a financial advisor, most people's idea of why they're hiring that person is because they're going to pick good stocks for me and they're going to allocate my assets in a prudent way. That's good. That's important. A meta-analysis of the research, so sort of a study of all the studies, shows that that accounts for about a third of 1% of value per year. So it's not nothing, right? But there's something that accounts for 244 basis points. So like, you know, eight times as much value, which is keeping that person from making behavioral mistakes with right. that money, keeping them from investing in their son-in-law's dumb startup, you know, keeping them from panicking, you know, keeping them from panicking in March of 2020 when COVID's running wild in the land,
right?
You know, keeping them from going all in on the latest meme coin or, you know, investing their politics or a million things. And so we're starting to understand that as an industry. And AI is going to hasten this, by the way,
yep.
because simple rules and algorithms and computers are always going to be better at allocating assets, picking stocks, you know, selecting product than you or I will be. So AI is going to hasten sort of the demise of the technical blocking and tackling of advisors like you and Sam. But it's also going to allow room for you all to be more human. And even McKinsey has a great white paper that's called Wealth Management 2030. And they say, look, in the not too distant future, the average wealth advisor is going to become a life quarterback. They're effectively going to be a life coach.
Right.
Because money touches every part of our lives. It's the number one stressor in the lives of Americans. And the role of a financial advisor is not going anywhere, but it's going to expand. It's going to become more human. And with respect to the actual investment decision making, it will become more automated, which will free advisors up to do the things that they do best and the things that add most value to the lives of their clients.
Darren and I both laughed when we were reading your book, because we always say, and in your book, you said, like, we should have gotten a psychology degree because it's so, it's a lot of investing, but it's a lot of emotion as well. That I personally, stepping into this industry, had no idea that I was kind of wearing that hat as well. So it's been interesting.
Yeah, and it really is. I mean, if you think about the investment aspect, we say this all the time as well, it's commoditized. I mean, are we really offering something that's, you know, earth-shatteringly different than a lot of the other places, firms out there? Yeah, the answer is no. I mean, the difference is who we are, how we interact with clients, and the client experience we deliver. And I think that we really need to continue to grow in terms of our behavioral finance skills, our communication skills. So it's encouraging to hear, because we've thought that all along.
So keeping the conversation moving, some of the most common behavioral biases you talk about in the book, if you had to pick, which ones do you see impacting people the most?
Yeah, so in a previous book, I took the universe of behavioral bias, which is like 200-ish different behavioral biases that impact our financial behavior, and I boiled it down to four: ego, emotion, attention, and conservatism. And the one that is sort of the granddaddy of them all is ego. And the reason I say that, ego is sort of the various forms of overconfidence. And the reason that I find it to be the most foundational and the most widespread is because if you're not aware that you're overconfident, none of the other stuff even sticks. Like if you're overconfident about your overconfidence, or if you're sort of blind to your overconfidence, none of the other biases even rise to the level of your awareness. And like we've talked about with these other behavioral biases, it does something wonderful for us as humans. Like, all of us think we are better looking, smarter, better, faster, stronger than the next person. In that book, men are especially prone to overconfidence, Darren. That's, you know, tough luck for us. But, you know, in this book, I cited research that showed that 100% of survey of 700 men, 95% of them thought they were funnier than average.
Of course.
100% of them thought that they were friendlier than average.
100%?
100%. And 94% of them thought that they were more athletic and better looking than average. So, you know, fellas.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, fellas, that's not how stats work, right? Like, we don't all get to be at the top of the mountain in every domain. And so overconfidence does a lot of good for us. It helps us get out of bed in the morning. And I mean, like, even what you do, Sam and Darren, the attrition rate for financial advisors is like 85%. Like, you know, 85% of people who start a financial advisory practice fail. And the same is true of most entrepreneurial journeys. It's true of restaurants in a big way. And yet we're glad that people start restaurants. We're glad that people take risks. So it serves us in a lot of ways. It gets us out of bed in the morning. It keeps us kind of floating on our own nonsense. That's fine. But when it comes to investing, you have to religiously strip yourself of this overconfidence that serves you really nicely other places in your life. And that's where it gets so difficult, is this thing that has served me so well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the whole reason I ever went and talked to the pretty girl in class and then married her, right? Is because I didn't know that she was out of my league. You know, that served me well there, but it serves me poorly in my investment life. And it's hard to make that distinction.
I can relate. As I was reading your book, you know, one of the things that stood out, one of the many things that stood out was your influences. So you are a Viktor Frankl fan, someone who has made an impression on you. Can you just talk a little bit about Viktor Frankl, and also maybe some of your other influences that have been impactful for you along the way?
Oh boy, I am a Viktor Frankl super fan. So when I read his book, Man's Search for Meaning, it's still my favorite book of all time. It's still the book I refer to others and gift to others more than any other book. And it is my, candidly, just my obsession. I'm already working on my next book, and it's going to be about meaning and purpose in life. And it's the subject of my podcast this year.
Great.
And what Frankl found, sort of cribbing this quote from Friedrich Nietzsche, was that he or she who has a why to live can bear with almost any how. And of course, what we mean by that is if you have a purpose, it will see you through the worst parts of life. And I mean, Viktor Frankl really had a front row seat to the worst thing that a human can do to another human. And his purpose saw him through that. So my influences would be existential thinkers like Frankl, Soren Kierkegaard, Frankl, Paul Tillich, people like this who write about the power of meaning, the power meaning has to transform us. And when folks read the book, I think they'll be surprised to know how meaning can even make our financial decisions a lot better. That candidly surprised me a little bit, but it's very, very powerful.
I look forward to reading the book. Yeah. So thinking about, you know, the pursuit of happiness and, you know, reading your book, the thought kept coming back to me was, you know, the pursuit of happiness is what makes us most unhappy, right? It's the job that I'm going to potentially get. It's the new house. It's the better car. It's the more athletic kids. It's always something in the future that is going to make us happy. And that pursuit is what eventually does make us unhappy. You actually talked about this in your first podcast, which I was happy to hear. Can you just expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. So the pursuit of happiness paradoxically makes us less happy, which I think is really confusing to a lot of people. And a lot of times it has to do with this over perseveration on being happy. You know, if you think about someone who, you know, said, hey, you know, Darren, does your knee hurt? You know, does your knee hurt? And, you know, at first you'd be like, it's fine. And then about the fifth time, you'd be like, you know what? It is a little creaky. Like, you know, now that I think about it, it has given me a little bit of trouble. And so we are so locked in on happiness sometimes and asking ourselves, am I happy? Am I happy? That we forget to notice the million little awe-filled moments of beauty that make us happy. We're so locked into this future state. And, you know, I say in the book, one of the chapters in the book is, I'll be happy when is a trap. And there's really two reasons why. One is this sort of over-focus on I'll be happy when, which leads us to obscure and miss these little everyday moments of happiness. The other thing is, again, one of humankind's greatest gifts, which is what shrinks call habituation. So, you know, if I ask you guys, you know, I won't do it because it'd be depressing. But, you know, say, so what's something you can't live without? And you'd be like, you know, if this horrible thing ever happened to me, that would be it. You know, I couldn't live without this person in my life, or I couldn't live if I lost this much money, or if I lost this person. And what we find in the research is that when you can compare paraplegics, like people who are in a horrible accident and become paralyzed, and lottery winners. And what you see is for the first couple of months, there's a sharp divergence, right? So of course, people who have been in a terrible accident and have lost use of their limbs, they are sad for a while. And people who have won the lottery are ecstatic for a while. And what we find is by the end of 1 year, those groups are back to where they started. You can get used to just about anything. And that is a good news, bad news proposition, because the good news is really tough stuff can happen to you and you are strong and you can get over it. The bad news is really good stuff can also happen to you. You can sell a company and get really rich. Like your portfolio can kick butt and you can make tons of money. You can retire. You can do a million really nice things. And it won't make you happy because you'll become acclimated to it very fast. So this human tendency towards habituation, our ability to acclimate to the very best and the very worst that life can throw at us, is both a gift and a curse. And I think we have to use it for what it's good for, which is overcoming adversity, and guard against it on the upside and really enjoy every moment of the process and not always be waiting for that finish line to cross, because there just are no finish lines in life.
Yep, such a good reminder.
Daniel, this has been such an insightful conversation, but I know our audience and I know our listeners love an actionable advice. So what are three practical steps they can take to apply the principles in The Soul of Wealth?
Okay. You can find your purpose, right? Not easier said than done, but we give some steps in there. You can find your purpose and tie it back to your dollars. You can exercise. I wrote a whole book on the physiology of sound financial decision making, and people don't understand that things like diet and exercise have a pronounced impact on the way that they think and feel about their money. And then the last one, and perhaps the most powerful one, is that you can be grateful. So I talk in the book about the power of gratitude, and there's research that shows that 5 minutes of journaling each day about something you're grateful for is as powerful in some experiments as taking SSRIs, like so stuff like Prozac, right? So it's an incredible boost in your happiness, like 10%. If there was a pill that people could take and become 10% happier,
yeah,
it would be Ozempic 2.0, right? I mean,
exactly.
it would be yeah, a $1 trillion drug. And you can have this if you take 5 minutes a day and journal about what you're grateful for. So those are a couple.
So find your purpose, get healthy, move, do something, and spend some time in the morning and find a way to create some gratitude. Journal, write something down. I love it.
That leads us perfectly into a tradition we have here on our podcast, More Than Wealth, is asking our guests a health and wellness question, because at the end of the day, wealth means nothing if you aren't healthy enough to enjoy it. So what is one health and wellness routine that you cannot live without?
Okay, so I do a couple of things. You can't see it, it's off camera here, but I wake up early every morning and I take my daughter to a pre-high school Bible study that she goes to every morning, but I'm usually up for about an hour every morning. And I walk on my little treadmill desk while I watch YouTube clips. So I usually get 3 or 4 miles in before I ever leave the house. And then I take her to school and then I go to the gym. So, you know, by 8 o'clock, I've usually hit 10,000 steps. I've gotten my lifts in.
Wow.
And I'm feeling good about life. The other thing that I do is that I track my macros. I track my nutrition every day. And that to me, I've lost 60 pounds in the last 9 months.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Wow.
Through tracking my macros. And it's wild. I've worked out for a decade, and it was only once I started getting enough protein and becoming aware of what I put in my body that it really started to take shape. So tracking just that awareness. And I mean, there's this direct analog to our financial lives as well. I wouldn't have told you that I was eating poorly. And honestly, I don't eat that. I'm not that rigid now. I eat sweets every day. The first thing I do is I get up and enter a Snickers bar into my app, because by God, that's happening.
A Snickers bar.
Snickers bar or Reese's cup, but depending on the mood, because whatever else happens, that's happening.
Yeah.
And, but it's just incredible to just know how you're fueling your body is just this really powerful thing. So that power of raising awareness has been transformative for me in the last year.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, you have to take care of yourself, you know, emotionally, physically, and to start the day like that, 10,000 steps before 8 a.m. I mean, you're winning before the day starts. So
yeah,
that's a great way to start the day. Thank you, Dr. Crosby, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of More Than Wealth. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to subscribe. Until next time, remember, true wealth isn't about what you have, it's about who you become. For Sam Hodgkins, I'm Darren Gold. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on More Than Wealth.
Thank you for listening to the More Than Wealth podcast. Click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. Visit our website at advisors.ubs.com/thegoldgroup or give us a call at 617 561-2662. And don't forget to click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Gold Wealth Management Group. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investing advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your investment planning.